I would say the pitch has changed in that I don't have to spend a lot of time anymore explaining why rowing. Like, people get it right away. They're like, oh yeah, I understand rowing is like really good exercise. I just, do people like it is now the question. Before, the question was, rowing's a niche. How can you ever grow this company to be large? We are entering into a somewhat terrifying golden age of personalized data management, which is going to allow us to deliver things that you really, really, really love. And basically, Hydro can do what TikTok does, but in a healthy way. You know, those groups of people, although they are like sort of culturally conservative, there are some incredibly smart and talented people who come out of those schools. And it's just, it's an amazing ecosystem if you can break out of that conservative, like go slow mindset.
Bruce, thanks for being part of this podcast. I'm really excited to do this together. I've been a really big fan of what you have built over the years with Hydro. We should start maybe with the prehistory. I know that you have a big prehistory in the space, and also your family was in the space of rowing for many, many years. So why don't we start with that?
Yeah, that'd be great. I know I have a prequel, the prequel to Hydro. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. So I started rowing at, you know, in college, and didn't totally like it. Was it became like a very strong interest. So I kind of like, I played a lot of piano through like high school, and I thought I would be a pianist. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I sort of replaced piano with rowing. And I got very involved, and I tried to make the Canadian national team. I did not make the team, but I started coaching, and really, like, I tried to quit a couple times. Like, I tried to like stop being involved, and found myself just, you know, kind of dragged back in. And then I didn't know this because nobody mentioned it to me, but like, my dad didn't row, my mom didn't row. But when my son was born, I picked a family name. And then we did some research about his name, which is Ruddock, R-U-D-D-O-C-K. And it turns out that W.W. Ruddock, and you can look this up on the internet, is my like great-great-great uncle, I think. And he built, this is so weird, but he actually built rowing shells. And he is credited with introducing the sliding seat in the 1860s and 70s. And he lived in Cambridge, where I live now, in Massachusetts, which is just totally wild. But it is this, there is like a hint of destiny about how Hydro got started. Like, we were definitely going to do this thing. There's no question about it.
And what was the first spark of the idea, would you say? Why did you want to start it?
I was working at a rowing club. I worked at community rowing for 10 years. I was the executive director. And the first 3 or 4 years, we had moved into this amazing building, this $20 million project. Really beautiful. It won a whole bunch of awards. It's this architectural gem in Boston. And the job was to fill that full of people and to pay off the building. And so that's what I was really focused on. And I realized that, like, even though we had this amazing building that you can see from the highway here, and it's like really beautiful, people didn't know that rowing was accessible. You know, they thought that it was something you had to go to Harvard for, or one of the local colleges. And it was like not something that anybody could do. And I don't think they understood the benefits either. So I started on this journey to try and make rowing feel genuinely accessible. And it used to be like 100 years ago, it was the most popular sport in the world. You know, the Boys in the Boat movie that's coming out is going to tell that story. But the convergence of trying to make rowing genuinely accessible and watching what Peloton did for SoulCycle. So SoulCycle was this really cool thing, and Peloton brought it into people's homes and made SoulCycle accessible to millions of people. And I thought that was amazing. And I was kind of terrified, honestly, that, like, stepping back for a minute, there is an inevitable shift towards more efficient and better exercises. And rowing is the most efficient and best exercise for your body. So there's this inevitable shift towards rowing. As people get more information, as people understand what's happening with their body, they really want to turn on their core. They want to use all their muscles. They want to feel great. Rowing is the future for sure. And I was really like, I was concerned because the sport of rowing just delivers such exceptional benefits, and being outside on the water and the rhythm of moving together with human beings really is this kind of human connection that's irreplaceable. And so I actually started Hydro because I wanted to make sure that as that shift happened towards indoor rowing machines as like the main modality for exercise, that was connected to the values and the beauty and the impact that the sport delivers. And if it became disconnected from that and just became like another dance class in your home with like pounding music and instructors yelling at you, like we would lose that connection. And rowing really is like, it's this thing that delivers human connection at a higher level than most other sports. You find flow and you find synchronicity faster with rowing than you do with any other thing. So that was the driving force, really, to make rowing feel accessible for everybody in the whole world. And then to deliver the benefits that you get when you're out on the water, moving with people and experiencing nature, to deliver at least part of that benefit to everybody around the world. And we didn't know if it would work, but then, you know, what do you know? It did totally. You know, we have our NPS score is in the 80s. People really, really like the product a lot.
And how did you move from conceptualizing the idea into actualizing it? How did you start? What was the first product? How did it look like?
It's kind of funny. You know, we got started. I'm a coach. So I coached. So along with being an entrepreneur, I've coached most of my life. And so I coached at a pretty high level. And I've been to the World Championships a bunch. And so in the wintertime, I would coach classes on rowing machines. And we would, at the rowing club, at Community Rowing, we'd have like 60 people come by in the morning and jump on ergs. Mm. And it was so frustrating because they would never row together, ever. Like you could not get the room to move together. Like people just, you could yell at them, you could count it out, but four strokes in, somebody would be off. And so we tried this experiment. One of the rowers that I worked with, actually, one of the people that I coached, I like coerced him into going out on the water and filming a person in a single skull. And then I projected that person in the single skull doing a workout up onto a wall. And I put 10 people on ergs and I watched what happened. And I didn't say a word. And everybody immediately synchronized themselves and fell right in with the person on the screen. And so that was like the first test. And I thought that we could start hydro at Community Rowing, but the board there wisely said like, hey, this doesn't fit exactly with our nonprofit mission. You should go and start a new company. And so that was basically like getting fired from my job there and taking those learnings and then putting them into hydro is how that was like the seed that germinated to get started.
Mm. So initially you had, because of your coaching experience, you had all these people there. So you knew that they would use the product once you start and you could do these experiments. And then how did you went towards with the product? Did you try to manufacture it somewhere else? Did you try to make it in Boston? How did you approach it?
You know, we had this kind of crazy thing. So Boston is like, it's like a second class city, you know, like, so I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's a really nice place to live. It's beautiful, but people here are, I know they're like politically liberal, but it's like a deeply conservative place where people go slow. Like, and you know, you think about Harvard, it's slow. There is a small group of people who like to go fast. And I'm one of those people who likes to go really fast. So we were really fortunate. I had built some relationships over the years with people who trusted my ability to get stuff done, and they invested in the company. It allowed us to basically start three companies all at the same time. And our goal was to go faster than Silicon Valley and really like go fast and see what we could do. So we started a hardware company, a software company, and a content company all at the same time. And that was literally the first meeting, like blank sheet of paper. For the hardware was January 4th, 2018. And that same month, we did our first shoot for content. And I've been working with our chief technology officer since December 5th of 2017. So we had like an MVP up and running by like February with the ability to deliver content. And we used a Concept2 rowing machine to test it all out on. And so we had like this incredible drive and the opportunity to go very fast. So we delivered our first looks like works like prototype in 6 months, which was our goal. So June 14th, it got delivered. It was a handmade, very, very expensive hydro that was like fully functional and kind of knocked everybody's socks off. It was a massive race. And that our first investor, Dick Cashin, who's the founder of One Equity Partners, he's a rower himself. And he kept saying, like, he just said, go faster. You're not going to win in rowing. There's this expression, you win by a bow ball. And what that means is that you win, these boats are 62 feet long and you win by 2 or 3 inches. So you just win by a tiny bit. And he said, you're going to win by a bow ball, not by a deck. And a deck is like you know, more substantial margin. So we knew that we were in a race against time because this shift towards rowing, it really is inevitable. And we knew that Peloton and everybody else was going to be building rowers. And so we really wanted to define the marketplace and you know, own rowing. And I think, you know, our market position right now, I think justifies that early speed and investment. Because it was really, we couldn't have gone fast without the right level of investment. Because it was always a choice, like good, fast, and cheap, pick two. That is a true statement. And we always chose good and fast. And we paid to go faster. And it was a good decision.
Got it. I want to go more in depth into the things you mentioned, but also I've seen somewhere that you pointed towards Harvard and MIT being there and that you wanted to be around the schools. Can you expand a bit more on that?
I definitely have kind of a love-hate relationship with Boston. So you have these incredible, deep pools of super smart people. Like, so I really thought that great brands had to start in Los Angeles, and if they weren't going to start in Los Angeles, they had to start in New York. And then with rowing, we were like, okay, no, we're actually going to start Hydro in Boston because of the history of rowing here. And it turns out that actually there are some really, really, really great engineers and mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, computer engineers, and also some great designers, which I didn't appreciate. And so I was really grateful. And that was kind of like a lucky choice because I really did do a national search to look for an engineering firm to partner with. And we found somebody in Lexington, which is one of the suburbs here. So it worked really well. Cooper Perkins was an amazing partner. Gerhard Pelecka was the lead there and we met on a Saturday in January. Everything was shut. There was this big snowstorm and we spent 4 hours just sketching out what we could build. And their chief technology officer, Chris Paul, he's like famous. This was his 8th, 9th startup, I think. And just extraordinary talent to... who really, they both schooled me on what we needed to do to be successful as a company because they'd had so much experience. So that those, to answer your question, those, you know, those groups of people, although they are like sort of culturally conservative, there are some incredibly smart and talented people who come out of those schools. And it's an amazing ecosystem if you can break out of that conservative, like go slow mindset.
And what was your approach in these days to attract these people? Were you going around the schools, for example, or?
No, it was all, I say this a lot. I don't know if this is fair to say, but warm introductions are everything. If you cannot earn a warm introduction, you do not have the skills to start a company. And I didn't, like, I'm Canadian. I didn't grow up here. I don't know anybody here. But I was able to, like, through sort of a network of friends to be introduced to Chris Paul. And that was, he was employee number one. And he had such a strong reputation and he'd done so many startups that as soon as he joined the company, it was very easy to attract people because he just had a fabulous network and people looked him up and they're like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. And I had asked, I had asked CP for a recommendation because there was no chance that he would work, you know, with me as chief technology officer. But I didn't realize it at the time, but in the course of getting to know each other, I bought him like, I think 7 meals. And he was kind of interviewing me as a CEO. And I thought we were just talking about the business. And he was excited to do something good in the world. And Hydro really is, you know, we're dedicated to help people feel better about themselves. And I think that combination of like the early win on talent with CP and also the mission of the company allowed us to hire, I think, the very, very best of the best, which is, I think, as everybody knows, you know, is crucial.
And in those 4 or 6 months that you mentioned that you launched the product, was the first product based with magnets as well? Was it working in the same way that the current product works?
Yeah. So the weird thing, I know a lot about rowing and how the stroke should feel and how it does feel with existing rowing machines. And rowing machines have been around for like 100 years. If you went to a Y in like 1910, there would be like rowing machines there. And they would use weights or springs or gasoline, you know, there are different kinds of mechanisms. And nobody had applied technology, like nobody. Like they were using old school resistance that was available 600 years ago. Like it was either a fan or like air or water, you know, like for the big ones. And it was kind of fascinating to me when we talked to the engineers, the remit, like I knew exactly how it had to feel like water. It had to be smooth and it had to be quiet. And we looked at a bunch of different mechanisms, but there are so many opportunities there. And the eddy current break is, it's pretty old technology. You know, people have been using it in printing presses and anything where you need to control speed or you have a spinning wheel, you can use an eddy current break. And so the technology was very available. The algorithm to create what we did is patented and special. And a lot of people have actually, like Peloton has copied it, you know, like where it's flattering. And it had been like literally 50 years since anybody had innovated. The concept to rowing machine was like the last major innovation. And that was really like the last big update they did was like in the early 90s. So, and that runs on a, you know, it's really a turbine, not a fan to create the resistance. So is that opportunity to leap forward, I think was really obvious. As soon as you stared at it, everybody's like, wait, why hasn't anybody changed this in such a long time? Because the technology really is much, much better. We use a small computer that we designed that controls the resistance on the eddy current brake, and that mimics exactly what it feels like. And it also has this really wide range of resistance. So you can have like almost no resistance or really, really massive resistance, and it changes through the course of the stroke, and it is immediately responsive to you individually. And I think one of the things we haven't done as a company is a great job explaining just how magical that is. It's really, it is a major step forward technologically. So
Engineering-wise, is this multiple magnets in a series, or how does it look like?
No, so it's an iron wheel. And then there are two electromagnets that are turned on and off 240 times a second by a small circuit board. And we created the circuit board and the firmware to, and it sounds pretty simple when I say it like that. It is not simple because it has to be responsive. So there's a feedback loop. So you push against the footboard and you hold the handle that spins the wheel. And as the wheel spins 240 times a second, it gets adjusted depending on how hard you are pushing. And it changes very dynamically through the course of the stroke. And then at the end of the stroke, we have to figure out where the end is, because everybody's finish for the stroke is different and everybody's start is different. And so there's a huge amount of computational power that's applied to figure out exactly how to make that perfect feel. And honestly, like, every single person who sits down in a hydro, their first response is like, this feels amazing, is great. That's the point. Feels like water. It really does.
It also sounds like if it's based on electromagnets and you have a circuit board, that you can update it as well if you want to do more innovations over time.
OTA updates. It is amazing. And so the opportunity to deliver, and we've done that already many times, and we continue to refine the feel and also make it more accurate. And over time, we'll also be able to introduce different kinds of exercises. So you can use it not just for aerobic training, but also for strength training.
In terms of the first content that you created, why did you choose the path of having a coach in the water? Why did you choose that approach versus an approach that it could be similar to what Zwift is doing, for example, in a virtual world and so on?
I know. I love Zwift. I think Zwift is really, you know, it's great. However, the key thing, so whole health is not just a physical thing. You know, whole health is really, like, human beings are, we haven't changed that much in the past, I don't know, 20,000 years maybe, but we require a few things to feel good. And one of them is exercise. That's great. That's a given. But another is experience of nature. And a third, and maybe the most important, and this is what I learned at community rowing, is that people need people to feel good. Like, it sounds like it's a trite thing to say, but if you don't recognize that, it's just crucial. And I don't know if you know any rowers, but like my experience of like rowers are all crazy. Like, never go to a rowing party because it's this tribe and all they talk about is rowing, and it's super boring for anybody who's not a rower. And so just don't go to parties with rowers at them, because it's not, as soon as you reach critical mass, it becomes a terrible party. And they have this like crazy connection, you know, that's built on moving in rhythm with other people on the water. And it's an amazing experience. And so it's really important to deliver that kind of human connection. And even with generative AI, like, we're so not there yet. Cameras are wildly revealing. And one of the biggest innovations for us was that rowers aren't allowed to talk and they're not allowed to smile. Like, when you're out on the water, when you're competing or training, it's a serious business. It's silent. Only one person's allowed to talk to the coxswain. Everybody else is specifically told to be quiet, and you really concentrate. And we broke a bunch of those rules to highlight that human connection between what's happening at home on the rowing machine and what's happening out on the water. So we film, you know, athletes who are rowing singles and doubles, and we film their face and we play music, and we really heighten the experience of connection so that what's delivered digitally really does feel like being genuinely connected to another human being. And you move your body in the same rhythm at the same stroke rate that the person on the water is moving with. And we encourage that. So it really transcends, I think, the digital divide in a way that pure digital experiences just can't, or they can't yet. There's exciting stuff happening with glasses, and I've built multiple test units for Oculus and other kinds of immersive glasses with 360-degree experiences. Once we get the form factor right on that, it'll be really cool. But for now, I think that heightened experience that we use sometimes up to a dozen cameras to capture the experience out on the water really does deliver like a substantial percentage of the reality of being out on the water yourself with it, with another human. It's really great. I love it. I'm genuinely surprised at how well it works. It seemed rowers certainly, like, we don't market for rowers. This is not, you know, it's not a product for rowers. But even rowers have decided that they kind of like hydro at this point, which is to me genuinely shocking. So really good.
Awesome. I want to actually ask you more questions about VR that you mentioned. I will leave it for the end. We spoke about content at the beginning. We spoke about the product at the beginning. What about marketing? How did you approach marketing? How did people learn about Hydro in the early days, in the first 6 months?
We used Indiegogo, and I was a little bit naive when I started the company about Kickstarter and Indiegogo. I thought that they were sort of, you know, homegrown, like, you know, that this shtick was real. What I didn't understand, which is so funny, looking back now, I'm like, oh, I was so naive. But the, you know, it's just that it's a straight up marketing tool. And you invest, you know, $200,000 or $300,000, and you get back $800,000 or $900,000, and it's just straight up advertising. And at that point, you know, Facebook algorithms and Apple algorithms were still working pretty well. So we had a really successful Indiegogo campaign, and we measured ourselves against Peloton. So Peloton sold like 125 bikes or something in their Kickstarter. We used Indiegogo and we sold close to 1,000 Hydros. And so we were like, oh my God, it's amazing. It's fabulous. And it was a key decision point. And the coolest thing was that of those close to 1,000 Hydros that were sold, fewer than 10% were purchased by rowers. And so we knew that this was a crossover product that could reach non-rowers. And that was a key test, because every single investor I talked to was like, well, rowing's a niche. There aren't very many rowers in the world. And, you know, I would explain the story about how it's a more efficient exercise, but they would say, like, who's going to do that work for education? And I would explain that, you know, all the work with Orange Theory and CrossFit, like those people had been educating people for a long time. So we weren't the first ones out with this idea, but It took some real proof, and that Indiegogo campaign was like a great way to get started. It was really, really compelling. And those were the first 1,000 machines that we delivered. And it was a great way to seed the market.
From those 1,000 that you had to create, did you have them, or did you figure the manufacturing after the fact?
I know. No, Indiegogo has some good rules. So you can't market on Indiegogo until you have a working, works like prototype, which is wise, because I think it cuts down on fraud. So we had a prototype, but we had only built 6 when we launched the campaign. And then we came close to meeting our timeline. We delivered the first 100 off the line in January of 2019, which was exactly a year from when we started, which was the goal, to get a hardware product delivered in people's homes. And then I think we delivered the last Indiegogo unit by like August of that year. So the first 1,000 came off the line, and we went through this really, I was hellbent on making sure that we got good reviews. And we manufactured in Taiwan. I spent quite a bit of time in Taiwan with the team, and we shipped them to Minnesota. this is not recommended. All the engineers were like, you're going to break more than you fix. But we took every single hydro out of the box. I hired rowers from the Minneapolis Rowing Club. And we put rowers on the machines and we tested every single machine, made sure it was flawless, put it back in the box, disassembled it, put it back in the box, shipped it to people. So we got great reviews. And then we did that for the first 3,000 units. And we were able to establish really high quality because we used that information from Minneapolis and fed it right back into the line in Taiwan. So it was an expensive process. It cost like about $140 a unit extra, but it meant that we had just amazing reviews. As soon as we opened up our review site, the first 100 reviews that came in were all 5-star. It was worth the investment.
Mm. And when you need to manufacture in Taiwan, how do you get to know people there? Did you get introductions or?
No, it was kind of a, so I was, again, like friend of a friend introduced me to a guy named Steve Ward. Steve lives in St. Louis and he has manufactured fitness equipment in Taiwan for his entire career. He used to work full-time for one of the big manufacturers and now he works as a consultant. And I talked to him and I didn't know him very well and actually like met him in person for the first time on the way to Taiwan. And it was kind of like, you know, here we are. I hope we get along. I hope you're a good person. He was great. He knows everybody over there. He spends a huge amount of time there and goes to everybody's weddings and funerals and, you know, knows their grandchildren's names. And it's pretty, you know, not a huge community, like pretty close knit. So our goal was to find a manufacturer who was not too big, not too small, who could handle the volumes that we needed, but for whom we would be a pretty important client. And we toured 6 factories that first trip, ate a lot of food and shared a lot of drinks with the owners of the companies and settled on SRS Great Fitness, who are a great first partner for us. And as soon as we were able, we diversified. So we have 2 manufacturing partners in Taiwan. But it was a really interesting process. They, you know, they see people like me coming from a mile away, but with Steve as a guide, we were able to, I think, get through. I wouldn't have been able to do it by myself. You know, like you need somebody who has strong local knowledge. And the first manufacturing experience, like it was expensive, but it was very productive, super fast. We met our goals in terms of production and then diversifying. Once we knew our way around Taiwan ourselves, having 2 manufacturers, although I do think that they all know each other and they do, you know, they all share acquaintances, at least if not friendships. We were able to, through that competitive process, make sure that we were getting really good prices. And that was really successful as well.
You mentioned that you saw 6 factories. How can you tell who are the really great ones? Do you see the product?
No. It's a really good question. So this is what happened. So they're very eager for business and they have a steady stream of people like me going through. They have a driver who comes and picks you up in usually a pretty nice van, like a Mercedes van or something. So you're staying at a hotel in some, you know, pretty industrial town in Taiwan. And there are 2 or 3 manufacturing centers that focus on fitness and they drive you to the factory. You go through a presentation from the management and you can tell from the management, like how sophisticated they are in their approach, how many engineers they have. You can look at their client list, you know, but what's most interesting is just going through the factory and understanding, do they have a soundproof room to check every piece? And is it actually soundproof? Like, cause if it's not a soundproof room, and they're doing their quality control without a soundproof room, then you know that they're not really serious about it. What is the engineering? So if they need some engineers to complete the drawings or to build the molds. When you go into the engineering area, how many engineers are actually in there working? And what's it like? Is it well organized? Like, is there dust on everything? When you look at their testing equipment, like, is it really high quality testing equipment or is it something that's totally jury-rigged? And they run for a little bit. Is it actually running? Like, are the test rigs running? Because you want those to be running 24/7. And so there are a whole bunch of things to look at. You know, what kind of cars do they drive? When you do go out to dinner, it's hard work, but there's a lot of drinking. And what kind of people are they? Are they the kind of people who go on to the second and third bar, or are they the kind of people who go home to their family? What are you comfortable with? And so it's like an exercise in being present. And I loved getting to know the people over there. They're really super, super smart, great business people. And I loved getting to know Taiwan a little bit. It's a really, really great place. And the people that we've gotten to work with are, I think, just idiosyncratic, cool humans. And they have their strengths and weaknesses. And it's an investment in relationship building. And in the quarantine, when we were building stuff, I actually did go, I put a high value on that personal thing. And I spent 14 days in a hotel room when I was in quarantine in order to go to a factory for like 2 days. So I think it's really, really important. And I don't think there's any solution, and it can't be a deputy. It's gotta be the CEO to CEO or owner to owner. You can't get to the bottom of things without that high level conversation. And in the end, I feel like I had some amazing guides. You know, we had a great partner with Cooper Perkins, and they came to Taiwan with me the first time too. So I had expert advice to help guide the conversation as well.
How many days would you say that it took you to really double down on the right manufacturer?
It was three trips to Taiwan. And yeah. I didn't know when we chose. I hoped. I crossed my fingers, you know. In the fullness of time, I figured out that our first manufacturer was really great people, super, super financially tight on money. They managed their money really, really well. Their quality control process was not what we needed it to be, and we had to work with them to change that. So it was a process, but there's a moment when you got to jump off and just go, and you find out later. I think the other thing, we had a superpower in our chief production officer who joined in August of that year. So I made the decision to work with SRS, and then a guy named Adam Kraft joined the company, and he'd been building things in Asia his entire career. Companies like Waterpik and Hasbro and Roomba. So he knew his way around Asia really, really well. And he had a really great manner and way of managing with the company to make sure that the quality was really high. That was our only real issue, was making sure that the quality was really, really consistent.
And then you mentioned earlier that you had 1,000 orders from Indiegogo, and then over time, it became 3,000. What would you say? Was it word of mouth from people that were really satisfied? Or what was the approach that got more people to learn about Hydro in those days?
Yeah, it was. So it was pre-pandemic. And the first, September, October, were pretty tough sledding. You know, we were just beginning to market. We hadn't raised our Series A. We'd raised about $10 million at that point. So we weren't spending much money in marketing. We just hired our marketing leader, and so we were just leaning in for the first holiday. The big breakthrough was actually Best Buy. You know, so Best Buy called us and was like, "Hey, we're entering the connected fitness space, and we want to enter it with you." And so that was just it was a huge moment. You know, I'm not sure that Best Buy is I know that they are as a long-term partner, they have their ups and downs, but as a way to launch a product as a young company, you can't really get better than that. They have this enormous reach. They're a trusted brand. And to have product placement front and center. And then that first year, we outsold bikes and treadmills on Black Friday. And we did a huge sale, $1,000 off. And that just blew the doors off. And we sold 1,700 units in that week, which was really it was amazing. It was a fabulous way to launch. Really, really good.
That's incredible. How did Best Buy learn about you? Or was it through media, or did they reach by themselves?
Yeah, they called us. And I think they were looking at the space, and we'd been to a couple of fitness shows. Their buyers were interested, and I think that they saw this as a growth category. You know, it was pre-pandemic, but it was definitely Peloton was growing, you know, like a weed. And I think they understood the shift for rowing, and they wanted to establish themselves as a premium brand. And we definitely had this very beautiful rower that was winning awards and that people really loved and was very high quality. So it was a really good match. And I went out and met the chief merchant of Best Buy, and we hit it off. He had a really great team. So it was a great way to launch. Really, it was really cool.
Incredible. You mentioned fitness shows. Which ones are useful that you liked?
There's sort of fitness is like kind of a lousy industry overall. You know, like it's been stuck in the past for a really long time. And it's starting to change. Like people have seen the light for sure. Like Peloton shook it all up. And we're shaking it up and Tonal shaking it up and Aura. But the legacy players like to go to those fitness shows. Like it was a bunch of people who, like, you know, those stores, like they're in like strip malls or like people who buy equipment for gyms and they have this like well-worn path. So it's a bunch of insiders who go to the show called Ursa in San Diego. And it's a good show. It's very well run, super professional. So we went to that. I think the most important thing to do if you're interested in the space is actually go to the show in Cologne every year, the international one. And everybody who's anybody goes there and all of the new stuff is there. So you can see how people are thinking about things. And the pandemic put a spanner in everything, but it was really, for me, that was eye-opening. And we didn't present there. We didn't have a booth the first year. But just going to see the context and understand how the whole industry sees itself, I think is really important to be able to position your product for that, especially on the commercial side. You know, it's a pretty small percentage of our business is commercial, but a high degree of awareness is attributed to commercial. So it's important to understand how the industry is marketing itself. And those are like the big shows from my perspective. There are a bunch of other things you can do depending on who you're trying to communicate with, you know, whether it's hoteliers or fitness people or gym people or, you know, there are different locations that you can go to talk to for those different groups.
Mm. What happened during the pandemic?
What didn't happen? It was crazy. You know, CACs were low, sales were high. We were supposed to produce 26,000 units the first year. We produced 30,000. We maintained quality. And it was just amazing. It was a wild ride. And then the next year we sold 60,000 units. So it was very, very extreme growth and very, very hard to manage. And we hired like a, you know, crazy and raised a huge amount of money and built a very large subscriber base. And, I know the pandemic was incredibly hard on people, but we are so grateful that we were able to grow like that through the pandemic. Cause it's, you know, there's been this huge, pull forward of demand. And if we hadn't grown enough during the pandemic, we would be in a very tight spot now because we know long-term market penetration is still not very high, especially for rowing. You know, the whole world is shifting towards better exercise. That pull forward of demand stranded a whole bunch of companies and they didn't have enough money to operate. And we are in a great position to resume growth this year. So we're super, super grateful for that period of growth. And it gave us a huge customer base and, you know, it's a great position to be in.
Speaking of fundraising, a lot of the folks that are looking at the podcast are early on. How did your pitch or your approach change over time, maybe from the seed days towards the later growth rounds?
So I have been through every kind of fundraising at this point. Early stage, definitely was lucky to know some people who trusted me to be able to accomplish something. And I can't say enough about L Catterton as an investor. So I made a long list of everybody that I wanted to invest in the company. L Catterton was the number one VC firm because they had a growth fund. Stage matched what we wanted to do. They understand the space. They're not scared by hardware. They have very deep pockets. They have private equity to follow on. They can follow you through the whole life of the company and a superlative reputation. So I started trying to get an introduction with them and I couldn't. I just couldn't get a meeting. And at the time I was like kind of frustrated. Like I was like, I have this great idea. Like this is really, really good. You know, it's going to work. And the fact that they wouldn't take a meeting was really frustrating. And it was honestly, like in retrospect, like that's why I say that ability to create warm introductions, if you can't do that, then you don't have the skills to be a CEO or a founder. You know, like you have to be able to open doors somehow and you can't just go knock on the door. Like it has to be like one step, two steps, and then the right door opens. And so it was building those relationships. And the pitch is, I would say the pitch has changed in that I don't have to spend a lot of time anymore explaining why rowing. Like, people get it right away. They're like, oh yeah, I understand rowing is like really good exercise. I just, do people like it is now the question. Before, the question was, rowing's a niche. How can you ever grow this company to be large? And, you know, investors are deeply conservative. Like, if it's not provable with data, they're like, well, I'm not going to invest until I know for sure. And that's the whole point of a startup. You know, like, it's a new thing. It doesn't exist. If it existed before, then it's not really a great opportunity. It's been commodified or something like that. So bridging that gap and the understanding, but it's moved from, I don't know why rowing could be hugely popular, to why is your company in particular going to be really successful? And that's been definitely a journey, and repetition, like getting rejected 100 times is incredibly valuable, not because the rejections make you stronger or anything like that. It feels like complete crap and it's a terrible experience, but just the repetition, being forced to explain over and over and over again, forces you to actually clarify your strategy, get smarter about your product, and understand how to communicate. And I think some people are better at it than others. I needed those repetitions in order to be able to make my point with investors. Like, I couldn't do it right out of the gate. I needed a lot of practice.
Mm. So the path to a yes involves a lot of no's.
Many, I've heard like so many fundraising presentations at this point, but even like in, you know, the prequel to Hydro, I used to do a lot of philanthropic work and a lot of fundraising. And basically, like, you count the number of no's that you get, because eventually you will get a yes. And if you haven't got 10 no's, then you're never going to get a yes. And it's the same with VCs. Like, you really need all of those no's. It's really important. And don't be discouraged. Like, practice.
You mentioned warm introductions. What are the nuances that people need to know? How can someone figure out the best way to get warm intros?
It's such a weird thing. But it's straight up, it's kind of like going to those factories in Taiwan. It's the same thing. Like, you get to know somebody. Like, so I worked with this guy, Howard Anderson, at Community Rowing. He was on the board of the nonprofit that I worked at. So I got to know Howard, and I dragged my ass up to Hanover, New Hampshire, 2-hour drive in the snow to meet with him for 45 minutes, which was like, it seemed like a total waste of time, but I didn't know Howard very well. And I brought a business plan, and we sat in the lobby of the Hanover Inn. And he like drove over from his home. He teaches at Tuck part of the year. And so he like looked at the thing and was like, well, and I thought he might invest. And he was like, I'm not investing. Like, what are you, crazy? But it was an open door. And so then I called him like a week later or 2 weeks later. And he was like, yeah, no, you know, okay, this is what you need to do, this and this. So I did that and that. And I wrote it down. And then I said, hey, can I talk to you again? And he came into the office where I was working. And so we got to know each other a little bit. And so that was like the first thread to pull. And then Howard knew everybody, you know, so Howard would go through the list, and he, you know, he's a successful venture capitalist himself. And he was like that first door opener. He introduced me to one of his students that he taught at Sloan, who he didn't know very well, but she was connected with another human who I talked to on the phone 3 times. He didn't invest, but I said, he said, hey, you need a CTO. And so that was like, okay, how do I get a CTO? Well, there's this guy, Chris Paul. Talk to him, ask him who you should hire. He'll have some ideas about who might, he won't work for you, but ask him. And then, so it was like, and you got it, like, at each one of those conversations is incredibly important. You know, like, it has to lead to the next one and the next one and the next one. And that's what I mean by warm intros. And if you can't build those threads, then you can't do it, because you can't do it by yourself. You know, unless you win the lottery and can just pay people. But if you pay people, it doesn't work very well. And at one point we had too much money as a company and hired a lot of consultants to do things very, very fast. And that does not build a sustainable business model. You know, like, the blitz scaling only works if the money stays free forever. You know, look at Uber. Like, it's, you know, and then $26 billion in, they're like, wait, oh, we have to make money now. Like, so it's those, that ability to build those threads without, and it's not money, it's relationships. And so that's what I mean by warm intro. And I think it's irreplaceable. I think it's basically what business runs on. which I didn't, like everybody talks about it, but I hadn't lived it that way before. I thought it was like much more like transactional, but it's transactional on a more human and personal level than you would expect.
That's an incredible insight. I wanted to take a bit, maybe another a few questions regarding the future. I wanted to hear your opinion about data in general. What is the approach in measuring data in Hydro, and how do you see it embedded in the product?
Yeah, the truth about Hydro is that we are actually a big data company. You know, I think we started life to get our foot in the door as an experience company and a workout company, but the magic happens when you can pair exactly the right experience with an individual that connects them with a community. And we are entering into a somewhat terrifying golden age of personalized data management, which is going to allow us to deliver things that you really, really, really love. And basically Hydro can do what TikTok does, but in a healthy way. You know, like we can make something that you love and we can deliver it to you at exactly the right time with exactly the right message. And all of that is just A/B testing and building on the relationship that we have with you and the data that you share with us that comes from your watch and your telephone. And that opportunity to marry that personalized data with insights about whole health is just remarkable. And we are on the first pitch of a really long baseball game, like a baseball game from last year. It's a very, very exciting moment. The industry, I think, kind of sort of sees it, but doesn't fully grasp what whole health is. There are a lot of people running around in fitness who rely on charisma and or used to work at a bank and think it's cool to own a fitness company because they're like fitness buffs. But the actual really deep information around whole health and the comprehensive understanding of what that looks like, and also the comprehensive understanding of what network effect is and how it actually functions, the nuts and bolts of network effect, like those are the two pieces of magic that we understand, I think, in a way that other companies don't. And we're just, you know, we're at the very, you have to build a great product that people love in order to have permission to play in this space. We've done that, and we're just starting to really lean into the opportunity there. And it's not generative AI. It's building on your personal story and what happens to you on a daily basis, and then using AI and the insights from that to put that together into a really great recipe. There are many, many, many companies right now overpromising because they're like, if you miss, like, so yeah, you can get a recommendation engine, but if it doesn't know about, like, say you had your watch thought that you had a good sleep, but you had a bad sleep, or you forgot to write down your second breakfast, you know, like, or it didn't record that you had 4 glasses of scotch the night before and you feel like complete crap in the morning, or you didn't hydrate. Like you were like running around all day and it was really hot and you didn't have salty food, so you feel like complete crap. Like those small bits of information create this really large chasm in what the recommendation should be. So we're far from being able to actually deliver against it. But over the next 2-3 years, like those are gaps that we are going to fill. And we'll be able to do it with a combination of, you know, really big data sets, looking at digital twinning and tracking information that you choose to share, and a really deep understanding of what whole health is.
How much of the data during the activity versus the data during your whole day would you be using?
You have to use it all because I know all of this stuff. As a national team coach, I was dealing with athletes who would do anything, literally anything, to win. Anything. I would do anything to win. I would, except cheat. You can't cheat because then it's not winning. So anything within the rules. Sleep, nutrition, mental state, emotional engagement. As important, if not more important than the workout. Like the workout is just one ingredient of many that goes into winning. And building that story required, like, I spent 40 or 50 hours a week on top of my regular job understanding the lives of like 12 or 15 people. And you couldn't just show up at the boathouse and be like, hey, this is what we're doing today. Okay, see you tomorrow, or see you tonight for the second or third workout. Like that was just a tiny fraction. And all of the really great coaches that I know have there was this Russian coach who coached me, and I'd come down to the boathouse, and he would just like stop me and look into my eyes before the workout. Then he would take my blood pressure, and then we'd go do the workout, and he would adjust from that. But he was an old guy who understood how people worked, you know, and it's that whole picture that allows for really great interventions. And without that, you have really bad training and people buying something that they think they're going to get and they never get it. And so it's the understanding that North Star and understanding what can be delivered and then understanding the gaps. And I think that's where fitness just fails miserably, because people buy fitness and they think like, oh, I'm going to lose weight and I'm going to look better, or six pack abs. And that never happens. You know, it just like that's determined by genetics and what you eat. You know, it's what we can deliver is the hydro high. Like, you will feel great. Give us 20 minutes. All of those chemicals in your brain that make you feel better for most of the day, like, we will deliver that guaranteed. And it's expanding on that promise in a way that doesn't disappoint people ever.
Small tangent, you mentioned hydro high. I saw all these ads from Kevin Hart. How does someone go and meet these folks? What's the approach?
I know. Kevin's really great. I met him during the pandemic, and he really is funny. And he was kind enough to laugh at a couple of my jokes. And I think one of them was like a real laugh. He wasn't just being polite. He was introduced to us from one of our investors. You know, it was once Catterton got involved, we got access to this whole world of people that they've worked with over the course of dozens of companies. And so we met a company called RX3. Nate Robbie, Aaron Rodgers, and Byron Roth started a venture fund. And Nate knows a lot of people in Hollywood, and he's a really, really good human. Like, he's there are a group of people in Hollywood who keep their word and follow through on promises and are trusted. And he is one of those people. So he knew Kevin socially, and I think had done some work with him. So we got introduced, and you know, Kevin's one of the hardest working humans I've ever met. Totally understands the fitness thing, and he's been on his own fitness journey. So for us, the key thing, like, when we talk, the point, he would have been happy to have his business manager just do a deal. We didn't want to do that kind of deal. We only wanted Kevin to be involved if he actually, because, you know, the camera is so revealing, like, it's got to be genuine. And he really, you know, he's just great. So he took a role, he took a title. He's our creative director, and he's still involved. Like, his contractual term is like long over, and he's still very involved. And when we call him, he always like throws up on social media, whatever we need, or like all of that work. And honestly, the hydro high, like that whole campaign, was because Kevin kept hammering, like, stop talking like in four sentences, make it really, really easy to understand. It's gotta connect with people like faster. And so we owe him a lot. It's been a great experience with him.
From this conversation, I got a few ideas, and my impression now is that the future of Hydro is going to involve, one, better understanding of the user through their daily life. For example, how did you sleep? What was your HRV? What was your blood pressure? What is your blood pressure during the activity? What is your glucose during the activity? So it's focusing on the individual much more and delivering a much, much more specific training. And then you mentioned something about Oculus. So I would assume that the world as well would be changing around you. So that's what it sounds from this conversation at the future. Can you paint a picture of that?
Yeah. I think it's so cool. I think that our understanding of whole health is just really powerful. You know, like, so the long-term, we say every week at a company meeting, you know, we want to create the most beautiful human experience. And we want to do that so that people don't just feel physically better, but they feel more connected to other humans. They have a higher degree of trust in themselves and in others, and are able to be more generous in the world and make better decisions. And that's our way to fight climate change. It's our way to fight the divisions in the world and to reorient people's imagination so that they actually have a better life. And it starts with delivering that craveable exercise that makes you feel connected to other humans. So I think, like, we're doing it now. Like, if you get a hydro, you absolutely feel better. That's why we have a crazy high NPS. but the opportunity to make it stickier and more craveable and actually fit in your life, depending on like, regardless of what's happening, is just a fabulous, fabulous opportunity that we couldn't even talk about like 5 years ago. We're running a pilot right now. Close to 40,000 of our members have shared their health data with us in a database, so they were able to start building this product. So it's very, very, very exciting. I think it's so much fun.
Excellent. For the listeners, where can they learn about you?
Oh, we are available online, hydrow.com. Six-letter homepage, hydrow.com, which we cherish. And if anybody wants a code, they should hit me up directly, bruce@hydrow.com.
Excellent. Bruce, it's been fun. Thank you so much.
Super great. Thank you very much for a great conversation.